Welcome to Lecture 10, The Copernican Revolution. We left off last time with a discussion of the Ptolemaic model for the solar system, which was based on the Earth being at the center and the planets orbiting around it. A breakthrough in our understanding of the solar system occurred when Nicholas Copernicus, a Polish astronomer, published his work on the sun-centered theory of the solar system. Now, as I mentioned last time, Aristarchus of Samos in the year 250 BC had essentially the same idea, but that work was lost. The original manuscript was lost in the Great Fire of Alexandria, and we only know of the result because of Archimedes' book, The Sand Reckoner. All other information is pretty fragmentary from Aristarchus's era. So Copernicus proposed that the sun is at the center, not that the Earth is at the center. And his view was really just a philosophically different one. It's not clear that he fundamentally believed that the Ptolemaic system had to be wrong. He just thought that this would be a different way to present the observations of the motions of the planets, and in particular of retrograde motion. He also was influenced by the idea that the sun might be the center of the solar system because it is bright, hot, gives the source of energy for life, and so on. Here we see in his book, Concerning the Revolutions, a diagram of the solar system that he drew. There's the sun at the center and the orbits of the various planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth with the moon circling it, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and then the celestial sphere of stars. So in this model, one can also explain the retrograde motion of planets, but in the following manner. Here we see the sun and Earth's orbit, with Earth at different positions in its orbit. Here is, say, Mars, a planet farther from the sun than Earth is, but this would work equally well for Jupiter or Saturn. And in fact, though the diagram doesn't show it, it'll work equally well for Venus and Mercury. Consider the perspective of someone on Earth at point A, viewing Mars at point A in its orbit against the backdrop of distant stars. And suppose Mars's position is here, point A among this backdrop of distant stars. Now, Mars, being farther out from the sun than Earth is, orbits more slowly. That was, in fact, known. That's a characteristic even of the Ptolemaic system. So when the Earth gets to point B here in its orbit, having traversed a rather long arc, Mars's arc will have been shorter. It will have moved only to this point here, B. And the position of Mars, as seen from Earth, will now be against a slightly different backdrop of stars. And the motion from point A to point B is from west to east, just as is normally the case, the so-called prograde motion. But now let's consider what happens when the Earth moves through point C in its orbit. Since it's moving faster than Mars is, it's essentially catching up with and passing Mars in its orbit. Here, Earth is at point C. Mars has moved a smaller amount to point C along its orbit, and now the projection of Mars against the backdrop of the stars is to a slightly different point, and it is in the opposite direction from that in which Mars appeared to be moving prior to this time. At point D, Earth has moved even farther in its orbit, Mars has progressed a little bit, and the perspective changes yet again. Mars is at sort of an extreme position in its orbit here, and all that time from point B through C to D, it has been traveling in a retrograde direction from east to west, very slowly, nightly among the stars. Then in going from point D to E and back to A, the normal prograde motion continues. At point E, an Earth person sees Mars against stars which are in a prograde direction from the previous point D. So you can see that Mars or other planets go through a loop, a retrograde motion loop, once each year, as the Earth appears to pass them by in its orbit. Thus, the observed retrograde motion of the planets is easily accounted for in the Copernican heliocentric sun-centered system. One did not need to postulate epicycles necessarily for this system to work. However, Copernicus did find that he still needed little epicycles on top of these circles because the perfect circles with which he represented the orbits of the planets do not, in fact, reproduce the observed positions of the planets very well. Copernicus liked perfect circles. He was still very much of the old school of thought in certain respects. He was a conservative innovator, is perhaps the best way to put it. He placed the sun with circular orbits around it, and he found that he did need some epicycles in order to get the observed positions to work out. Copernicus also found that the sun could not be centered on the circles. It had to be a little bit off-center. That is, the orbits of the planets, which were going around the sun, were not centered on the sun itself. If they had been centered on the sun itself, he wouldn't have been able to get very good agreement with the observations. So this system, in fact, worked pretty well, but it did not give markedly more accurate results than the Ptolemaic system. In fact, the Ptolemaic system could be made arbitrarily accurate by adding additional epicycles. One could not argue that Copernicus's system gave better results. It was more of a philosophical perspective that led him to this conclusion. He was a little bit reluctant to publish this conclusion. His work was supported by the Pope. He was a devoted Catholic. He dedicated his work to the Pope. And he waited to the end of his life to have it published. And in fact, a student of his oversaw the publication of the work and handed him a copy at his deathbed. There's an interesting disclaimer on the front page of Copernicus's book, De Revolutionibus, saying that this is just a model, it may not be true, we don't necessarily believe it, and all that. You're led to believe that Copernicus wrote this disclaimer, but later it was found that that was not Copernicus's style. Someone else wrote that disclaimer. It was Galileo who showed that the heliocentric, sun-centered model was the correct one for the solar system, not the geocentric model. Galileo observed the phases of Venus. He saw that Venus goes through a complete set of phases from full Venus to quarter Venus all the way to crescent Venus, just as the moon does. These phases go through a series over a few months' time, and it took quite a while to get the necessary observations. The complete set of observations took a while to get, but it provided the fatal blow to the Ptolemaic system, or the Ptolemaic model for the solar system. Let's see why that's the case. Here is a diagram showing the configuration of the Earth, Venus, and the Sun in the Ptolemaic model. It was known that Venus is somewhere between the Earth and the Sun. That was a known fact. In fact, Venus sometimes goes across the face of the Sun. It is also an observed fact that Venus is never very far in angular distance, in angular separation from the Sun. You never see Venus diametrically opposite the Sun, for example, overhead at midnight. That's just simply never seen. Venus is always close to the Sun. Therefore, the only phases that could be observed in Venus in the Ptolemaic model are crescent Venus, the two crescents, and new Venus, when it's in between the Sun and the Earth. The crescent phase and the new phase are the only observable phases in the Ptolemaic model. Well, what was observed was a complete set of phases. So this was clearly an inconsistency. Now, in the Aristotelian view, this would not be a problem because, again, the observed world is only an imperfect reflection of the true reality out there. But Galileo believed what he saw. He believed that what he saw represented reality. And he saw, in fact, that the Copernican system nicely accounts for the phases of Venus and for the angular size of Venus as well. In the Copernican system, both the Earth and Venus orbit the Sun, with Venus being between Earth and the Sun. Now, when Venus is close to the Sun, but between the Sun and Earth, you see that crescent phase. When Venus marches its way around its orbit over to this position, you see a bigger crescent and almost, in fact, a quarter Venus phase. Notice its angular distance from the Sun is still small, consistent with observations. It is not seen opposite the Sun in the sky. It's not being seen at midnight. It's still close to the Sun in angular separation. However, it's moving out behind the Sun from our perspective. And so when Venus enters this phase of its orbit, you can see that it looks gibbous. And when it's almost directly behind the Sun, it looks full. Again, it's close to the Sun in angle at all of these phases, so that does not violate the observation that Venus is always close to the Sun in the sky. But it does provide a way of getting full Venus and gibbous Venus. So there we go. The Copernican system accounts nicely for the phases of Venus, and the Ptolemaic system fails miserably. This, according to most historians, was the main real fatal blow to the Ptolemaic system. Although, again, if you don't really want to believe what you see, anything is possible. Another interesting observation is that Jupiter has four moons. Galileo discovered this in 1609 when he used a telescope to study the heavens. He found that Jupiter has four little ducklings kind of following it as it moves through the sky. And night after night, he watched these little satellites, and he saw that they orbit Jupiter. They move back and forth with different periods. One of them goes quite quickly, just after 1 or 2 days, maybe 2 days. The other ones go more slowly. But they clearly orbit around Jupiter. This was significant for two reasons. First of all, it showed that Earth is not necessarily the only object in the solar system which can have other objects orbiting it. Jupiter has a family of moons that are orbiting it. So clearly the Earth is not a unique object endowed with powers that allow it to have other objects orbiting it. Jupiter can do the same thing. Moreover, since Jupiter was clearly moving through the sky, orbiting either the Earth in the geocentric system or the Sun in the heliocentric system, but nevertheless moving in both systems, the moons keep up with it. They are moving with Jupiter as well. And that suggested that motion of an object does not necessarily leave behind other objects that happen to be near it. Remember that one of the objections to the heliocentric idea was that if the Earth were moving through space, humans and rocks and things would be left behind. And if Earth were spinning, they would be left behind as well. But here, this observation clearly showed that Jupiter was moving through the sky and its family of moons was not left behind. They, rather, were dragged along with Jupiter for some reason that Galileo did not yet understand. So the observations of Jupiter's moons are considered very significant in the downfall of the Ptolemaic model, but they are not quite the fatal blow that the phases of Venus were. Another thing that Galileo did with his telescope is to see that the moon is pockmarked with craters and all sorts of blemishes. Now, even with the unaided eye, one can see that the moon is not uniformly bright everywhere on its surface. But it was not really known whether these are just color variations or whether they're actually pockmarks on this sphere. Jupiter, or the moon, clearly has these craters and mountain ranges and vast plains. And Galileo discovered this with his telescope, showing that the heavenly bodies out there are not perfect spheres. They have blemishes on them. All right? And this was considered somewhat of a nasty thing in the Aristotelian model. The heavenly bodies are supposed to be perfect. And in particular, the Sun is supposed to be perfect. But the Sun, too, has blemishes. Galileo saw that it has sunspots, dark spots on it, pimples. Well, how could a godlike thing like the Sun have pimples? How could the moon have blemishes? These things, though not fatal blows to the Ptolemaic or Aristotelian systems, were certainly disquieting to people. And this sort of work was kind of, you know, stifled a little bit. People didn't want Galileo to talk about his results because they went against the feeling that the heavens out there are perfect in some way, made of perfect spheres, things like that. Interestingly, Galileo also studied Saturn, and although he could not discern the rings of Saturn, he did see that Saturn had a distorted shape. It looked almost as though Saturn has handles sticking out of it. Now, that's not really relevant necessarily to the Ptolemaic system, except that, again, Saturn was a heavenly body out there associated with gods, and why would gods have these, you know, ugly-looking handles sticking out? Well, one final thing that Galileo found was that the Milky Way consists of innumerable stars. It is not just some sort of white patches of paint painted across the heavens. It contains innumerable stars. And it's not clear whether he realized that those stars are suns like our own, but certainly this was an important discovery that he made with the telescope. Well, poor Galileo was badly reprimanded for saying all of these terrible things about the heavens, that they have blemishes, that the Earth really does orbit the sun. He also believed in atoms, as did Democritus, and this was, for some reason, a no-no. I'm not exactly sure why. The Roman Catholic Church was quite upset by the sorts of things that Galileo was saying, and the Inquisition sentenced him to house arrest for the rest of his life. He really couldn't go on using his telescope and writing about his discoveries. It is said that when he knelt before the Pope, apologizing for what he did, that he murmured, "Yet it moves," under his breath. But it's not known whether that story is apocryphal. In any case, Galileo was sentenced to house arrest, and that's sort of too bad for him. However, in the long run, it was good for the development of science, because it allowed Galileo to conduct his very important experiments on the nature of falling bodies and balls rolling down inclined planes and things like that. And we will see that Newton used Galileo's observations to determine, to state his laws of motion. And indeed, this is among Galileo's most important work, which he did while sentenced to house arrest. It is said often that he did this work by dropping balls off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. That story is probably apocryphal. It's more likely that he rolled balls down inclined planes and things like that. However, it makes for a nice story. And the fundamental result is that Galileo found that different bodies accelerate. They speed up at the same rate when dropped from above the floor. So here's a lead ball, and here's a much lighter tennis ball. They're about the same size, but it doesn't really matter. Neglecting air resistance, this experiment would work perfectly. It might not work perfectly because of air resistance and because I might not drop them simultaneously, but let's see what happens. There. They dropped simultaneously. They hit the floor simultaneously. And this is true regardless of the height from which I start. Like that. Now, that's kind of weird. You know, the lead ball is really heavy. You'd think that it would fall faster. But it doesn't. And this experiment has now been done on the moon with a feather and a ball. In fact, I think a feather and a hammer were used. They were dropped simultaneously, and the feather fell just as fast as the hammer. This has also been done in vacuum chambers here on Earth. Get rid of the air resistance so that the feather is no longer supported by the air, and you will find that the feather and the ball or the hammer fall equally fast. They get accelerated equally fast. This was very interesting. The other thing that Galileo found was that if you decreased the amount of friction on your table, you could get a ball to roll a very long distance, suggesting that perhaps motion is the natural state of objects, not necessarily rest. I mean, they can be at rest if you place them at rest, but if you put them in motion, maybe they tend to remain in motion rather than come to rest. Aristotle believed that the natural state of everything was to come to rest, and that you needed some sort of a force, a prime mover, pushing on it to get it to continue along its motion. Well, when I visited Italy in 1979, after I finished my undergraduate work, I saw the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and I wandered around in Florence, and I came across a wonderful little museum of science along the banks of the Arno River in Florence. And this was just a great little museum. It had some of Galileo's earliest telescopes, in fact, I think his first one. It had all sorts of microscopes and early measurement tools and things. It was just marvelous to look at. But off in one corner of the museum, I saw a curious sight. I saw what looked like a little jar with a stick in it. And here is a photograph of what I saw. That little stick in there is actually the middle finger of Galileo's left hand. There it is, the middle finger of Galileo's left hand. Now, I was aware that at that time Europeans liked to take vertebrae and other bones of famous people and place them in different churches just so that different churches would have the honor and the privilege of having part of the remains of these great people, artists and scientists and whatnot. But I didn't realize that they take fingers off of people. And this is perhaps ironic that it's the middle finger of his left hand. By some accounts, it's the index finger. I've read different historical accounts of this. But I prefer to think of it as the middle finger of his left hand. That could be Galileo's response to the church after it was shown later in successive centuries that very clearly the heliocentric model is the correct one. And in fact, the Pope, a few years ago, officially pardoned Galileo for the things that he stated. Fortunately, Galileo lived to be an old man. A contemporary of his, Giordano Bruno, had been burned at the stake for expressing various heresies, such as the heliocentric hypothesis. All right, well, let's go on now to Tycho Brahe. We're actually moving back in time a little bit right now to the late 16th century. Tycho was born to a Danish noble family in 1546, and at the age of 14, saw a partial eclipse of the sun from his homeland, Denmark. It had been total in Portugal, and astronomers had predicted that there would be this total eclipse and that it would be partial in Denmark. And Tycho was so struck by the predictive ability of astronomers at the time that he decided to devote the rest of his life to making better observations to see whether the predictions really were very, very accurate, and if not, to see what sort of modifications could be made by others to the various models. So he made all these interesting observations. He was a rather arrogant fellow, very pompous, very argumentative, and at the age of 20, he dueled with a fellow student, and in the duel, his nose was cut off. It was then replaced by a gold-silver amalgam of some sort, and supposedly he continually rubbed ointment on it throughout the rest of his life. So he had a golden nose. He did most of his work on an observatory on an island in Denmark. The island was called Hvin, and the observatory was called Uraniborg. But the king of Denmark passed on and was replaced by another one, and Tycho fell out of favor with the court, and his funding was removed, and so he was essentially forced to leave Denmark, and he settled in Prague at the invitation of the Holy Roman Emperor. In 1601, after having made 20 years of very precise observations of Mars and other planets, he was drinking heavily at a dinner party, and proper etiquette did not allow people to leave that party before the Baron had left. So apparently he stayed there a bit too long, got a bladder infection, and died 2 weeks later. He lived a very vigorous life, drank a lot, ate a lot, and died prematurely due to his excesses. Well, fortunately for science, Johannes Kepler, a very mathematically able assistant of Tycho, got hold of Tycho's data. He had been working with Tycho for about a year, only about a year, analyzing the data. But Tycho had been very stingy. He'd kind of give a little bit of data at a time, and this left Kepler quite frustrated. Upon Tycho's death, Kepler tried to get all of the data, but Tycho's relatives did not want to give Kepler all of the data, after a lot of haranguing, you know, a lot of arguments and things, Kepler did get a hold of the data, and he was then able to analyze 20 years worth of these precise observations, the most precise observations of the positions of planets that had ever been done. They were done before the invention of the telescope, but Tycho used instruments with which he could measure these positions very, very well. So what did Kepler find? Well, he found that he needed to modify the heliocentric hypothesis a little bit. Actually, these were fundamental modifications, but not in the sense that he took the sun away from its central position. Rather, he found that the orbits are ellipses, not circles, as Copernicus had postulated. And the sun is at one focus of the ellipse. Well, an ellipse, as we've seen before, is a conic section. It's what you get when you cut a cone with a plane, not quite perpendicular to the axis of the cone. You get an ellipse. All right, there's an ellipse. And ellipses have the property that the sum of the distances from any point on the ellipse to each of the foci, each of the two foci, is a constant. So if one distance is called little a and another distance is called little b, a plus b is a constant. The sum of the distances from the foci is a constant, and that's the locus of points called an ellipse. So that makes an ellipse very easy to draw. I have here a sheet of cardboard with two pens or pins and a pen and a string. The string clearly has a constant length, and the distance between the pins doesn't change. So if I pull this string tightly like that and then just draw the figure with my pen, I will get an ellipse because the string's length doesn't change. And hence, that is indeed the set of points, the sum of whose distances from the two foci is a constant. The Copernican system worked as well as it did, in fact, because Copernicus had placed the sun slightly off-center from these circles, these circular orbits. The orbits of the planets in the solar system are, in most cases, only slightly eccentric ellipses. They're just slightly flattened circles. And an off-center circle works nearly as well as an ellipse in describing that motion. It was only because of Tycho's observations that Kepler could discern the difference in the prediction of an off-center circle and an ellipse where the sun is at one focus. Let me define a couple of more aspects of an ellipse. The long axis is called the major axis. Half of it is the semi-major axis. It turns out that the average distance of a planet from the sun is roughly equal to the semi-major axis. And so it's often said that the average distance of the Earth from the sun is equal to the semi-major axis, and that's true. The semi-minor axis is just half of the minor axis, or the small axis of the ellipse. All right, so the orbits of planets are ellipses, not circles, with the sun at one focus. Kepler's second law states that a line segment joining the sun and a planet sweeps out equal areas in equal times. Here's what that means. If you have the sun and the orbit of a planet, then what Kepler's law says, Kepler's second law says, that the time it takes for a planet to move from position 1 to position 2 is the same as the time it takes to move from position 3 to 4 at a different part of the orbit. And that time is dictated by the rule that the area swept out must be equal in the two cases. So here, the planet is close to the sun, so the segment is short. Therefore, in a given time interval, the planet has to move quickly in order to sweep out a large segment of the pizza pie. Whereas when the planet is far from the sun, it doesn't have to move very quickly in that time interval in order to sweep out an equal area. This second law essentially tells you how quickly a planet moves in different parts of its orbit. It moves just quickly enough so as to sweep out equal areas in equal times. And that's Kepler's second law. I should mention that Kepler's three laws were hidden in a voluminous discourse, Baroque discourse on music and harmonics and all sorts of stuff. And it was not later until Newton sort of dredged the essence of what Kepler was saying out of his work that these laws became well known. Kepler's second law is most easily manifested, or most vividly manifested, by the orbits of comets. Here is the orbit of Comet Halley. It orbits the Sun in about 76 years. It spends almost all of its time way out here, far away from the Sun, between or close to Neptune's and Pluto's orbits. Just sort of moves slowly, 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 because the segment joining it to the Sun is very long. And so to sweep out a given area, it doesn't have to move very quickly. Then as it gets closer to the Sun, it starts accelerating, and it whips past the Sun very quickly so as to sweep out an equal area in a given amount of time to the area that was swept out when it was at a great distance. So comets spend most of their time far away from the Sun, and then as they get close to the Sun, they whiz on past and then go far away again. So comets are fairly ephemeral phenomena here as seen from Earth, because they spend most of their time far away. And that is really a direct illustration of Kepler's second law. Kepler's third law is that the square of a planet's orbital period is proportional to the cube of its semi-major axis. Mathematically, we can express that as p squared, where p is the period, equals k, a constant, times r cubed, where r is the semi-major axis, but you could just as well say the average distance of the planet. So p squared is kr cubed. The square of the orbital period is proportional to the cube of its average distance, or semi-major axis. Now, these were purely empirical laws. Kepler had no physical explanation for them. They were deduced from a careful analysis of Tycho's wonderful, wonderful observations. The observations that existed prior to Tycho's time were insufficient to show at least some of these things, like the distinction between a slightly elliptical ellipse, a slightly eccentric ellipse, and a slightly off-center circle. Let's take a look at what Kepler's third law is really telling us mathematically. Kepler called this third law his harmonic law. He was searching for musical relationships in the cosmos. In fact, his whole life was sort of centered on the musical harmony that he thought existed out in the cosmos. He spent a good fraction of his career investigating the perfect geometrical solids, things like squares and a pyramid, objects that have sides whose areas and shapes are equal. He wanted these things to be nested inside the orbits of planets. He wanted to see all sorts of musical relationships with that. He was into geometry, music, and harmonics. And when he did finally see some sort of a mathematical harmonic law come out of his studies, he was ecstatic. It was not exactly what he expected to find. He wanted to find these geometrical solids, but that's not what he found. He found his third law. It's convenient when considering the solar system to use units based on Earth's orbit. So suppose we write down two equations. And again, you can ignore these quantitative relationships if you want to, or the examples, the quantitative examples I'm about to give, you can ignore them. If you just remember the fact that the square of the period is sort of goes in proportion to the cube of the distance, that means that qualitatively, the more distant a planet is from the Sun, the more slowly it moves in its orbit. And there's a mathematical relationship expressing that quantitatively. But the slow planets are the ones that are farthest out from the Sun. But let's just look at this quantitatively, because it's insightful to do so. We can write down two equations. The square of the period of any arbitrary planet is equal to k times the cube of that planet's average distance from the Sun. And we can write down that same equation for the Earth. P squared of the Earth is equal to kr cubed of the Earth. Now, the constants cancel out. It's the same constant in both cases. All right? So we can divide then the two equations by each other and take the square outside the parentheses and just say that P planet over P Earth quantity squared is equal to the ratio of the distances R planet over R Earth quantity cubed. Now suppose we express the period of the planet in years, in Earth years. The Earth goes around the Sun in 1 year. Some other planet goes around the Sun in some other number of years. But if we express that other number in units of years, then the years cancel out, and you will see that you're expressing the planet period in years. The Earth's orbit is expressed in terms of 1 year, and then you just have a pure number here, like 5 or something like that. So you'd get 5 squared. Well, if you also express the distance of the planet in units of the Earth's distance from the Sun, then again, the units cancel out nicely. The unit of distance that we will use for the Earth from the Sun is one astronomical unit, 150 million kilometers, or 93 million miles, is called one astronomical unit. If we express Earth's distance in terms of 1 AU, and we try to calculate the planet's distance in terms of AU, astronomical units, then again, the equation is very simple. Let me give an example. Suppose you measure the period of Mars to be 1.88 years. So you look at Mars, as Tycho did, over the course of several years, and you notice that it takes it 1.88 of our Earth years to complete one orbit around the Sun, to return to the same point among the background stars as the point from which it started at the beginning of your observations. That's 1.88 Earth years, all right? So you express that quantity in years, and you put it in this equation. You have 1.88 years. Earth's period is 1 year. The years cancel out, and you simply have 1.88 squared. There it is. It's some number. You can do it on your calculator. Well, then you have to ask yourself, what number, when cubed, gives that number that's 1.88 squared, which is, I don't know, 3.56 or something like that? What is the cubed root of 3.56? Well, again, you can punch that into your calculator, and you find that it's 1.52. 1.52 cubed is the same as 1.88 squared. And the units of 1.52 are astronomical units, because again, I've expressed the distance of the Earth from the Sun in astronomical units rather than using some messy large number of kilometers. So what this says is that Mars's semi-major axis is about 1.5 times Earth's semi-major axis. Mars is about 50% farther from the Sun than Earth is, and it moves more slowly in its orbit as a consequence. So you can now go and measure the orbital periods of other planets, Saturn or Uranus or Venus or Mercury. It works for all of them, and calculate their distances. And in fact, the way Kepler found this relationship is that the relative distances of some of the planets were known pretty well by that time. So he used Tycho's observations of the positions of planets to get the periods and things like that, and he empirically saw that this relationship holds. This relationship between the square of the periods and the cube of the distances. And he called this the harmonic law. We will see that this law, Kepler's third law, is enormously useful in much of astronomy. Later on, we will calculate the mass of the central region of a galaxy, in the central region of which the stars are really whizzing around, and we will use Kepler's third law to find the mass and to deduce that that mass is so large that there is probably a black hole hiding in that galaxy. Kepler's third law is also used to deduce the masses of, for example, the planets. Jupiter's mass can be deduced by measuring the orbital periods and distances of Jupiter's satellites, its moons. Now, Kepler did not know that his laws were universally applicable. We will see in the next lecture that Newton figured that out. But they are applicable to other bodies, not just to planets orbiting the sun. Let's take an interesting example of the use of Kepler's third law in calculating where a satellite should be in order for it to orbit around the Earth at exactly the same rate that Earth rotates about its axis. Now, Earth rotates about its axis at 15 degrees per hour. That's because a full day, a full rotation, is 24 hours long, and there are 360 degrees in a full circle. So 24 times 15 is 360 degrees. So it rotates at 15 degrees per hour. Well, low Earth orbiting satellites like the Hubble Space Telescope really whip around the Earth. They're close to the Earth's surface. They feel the intense gravitational pull of the Earth. I'll discuss that in the next lecture when talking about Newton. And they go zipping around, and it takes them actually only about 90 minutes to orbit the Earth. They move 230 degrees in 1 hour. Anyway, it's a 90-minute orbit. The Hubble Space Telescope orbits the Earth in about 90 minutes. Okay, so you can say, given that I know that a satellite that's essentially at the Earth's surface, just 200 kilometers above the Earth's surface, orbits with a period of 1.5 hours, 90 minutes, what would be the altitude of a satellite that orbits the Earth in exactly 24 hours? Such a satellite would appear stationary above a particular point on Earth. Such satellites are called geostationary satellites because they orbit around the Earth at precisely the rate that Earth rotates about its axis. Well, we would want the orbital period to be 24 hours. 24 divided by 1.5 hours squared, p over p squared, has to equal the distance of the satellite from the Earth's center divided by the distance of, or divided by the Earth's radius, essentially, quantity cubed. So the ratio of the square of the ratio of the periods must equal the cube of the ratio of the distances. The two relevant distances are Earth's radius plus 200 or 300 kilometers, about the same as Earth's radius, and the unknown distance of the satellite from Earth's center. And the reason I emphasize center is that Newton showed that gravity acts as though all of the mass were concentrated at the center. Well, if you do that simple calculation on your calculator, you find that a satellite must orbit at a distance from the center equal to about 6.5 Earth radii. That's a distance of something like 41,000 kilometers from the center of the Earth, or a distance of some 34,000 kilometers, 34,000 or 35,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface. That's the distance of a satellite that orbits in the same amount of time that it takes Earth to rotate through one day. So its angular motion across the sky is at a rate of 15 degrees per hour, just as is the case for the Earth's rotation. That's 15 degrees per hour. So it stays put above a given location on Earth. You can see it above you if you had sufficiently powerful eyes, and it would stay above you. And you can immediately see the utility of such a device. It can be used as a communications satellite, always stationed above a particular radio telescope on Earth. They're used for monitoring weather things, storms, things like that, but mostly for communications. And this has been used quite a lot in the past few decades. We've all made use of these sorts of satellites, and it's fun to see where it is in the sky that they are. They're about 35, 36,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface. Now, in the next lecture, we will see how Newton used his laws of motion and his law of universal gravitation to derive and extend Kepler's three laws. He showed how they are derived from more fundamental relationships and how they can be extended to apply to objects throughout the universe, not just to planets orbiting the sun. Critical to Newton's work were the observations of Galileo and the insight that he gained in looking at nature, observing apples, the moon, and so on.